Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the vast oil, gas and chemical infrastructure along the Gulf Coast that is being battered by ocean surges and inundated by flooding from Hurricane Harvey. Representing a large part of America's oil and gas infrastructure, this concentration of refineries could not be in a worse place because of their proximity to bayous and wetlands, and with the increasing frequency and severity of superstorms, more and more massive releases of oil and gas and toxic chemicals are happening and will get worse. Scott Eustace, a water policy analyst and coastal wetland specialist at the Gulf Restoration Network in New Orleans, joins us to discuss the open pits of chemical waste now underwater and the chemical waste from purging the refineries as they shut them down, which is now mixed with flood water and spreading its pollution into low-income neighborhoods around the refineries and seeping into the protected bayous and wetlands. Then we'll get a scientific analysis of the role of global warming in making Hurricane Harvey one of the worst unnatural disasters to hit the United States as flooding continues around Houston and the coastal regions of the Gulf. Michael Mann, the director of the Earth Systems Science Center at Penn State University and the author of The Madhouse Effect, How Climate Change Denial is Threatening Our Planet, Destroying Our Politics, and Driving Us Crazy, joins us to discuss his article at The Guardian, It's a Fact, Climate Change Made Hurricane Harvey More Deadly, and that there will be an increase in the intensity and the amount of precipitation in future hurricanes as global warming causes ocean temperatures to rise. Then finally, we'll speak with Harry Stein, the Director of Fiscal Policy at the Center for American Progress, about President Trump's presentation today in Missouri of his tax overhaul plan that was light on details but heavy on promises, with a cut in the corporate tax rate from 35% to 15%, one of the few specifics. We'll discuss how that giveaway comports with Trump's promise that, quote, it's time to give the American workers a pay raise that they have been looking for many, many years. And joining us now is Scott Eustace, who is a water policy analyst and coastal wetland specialist at the Gulf Restoration Network in New Orleans. Welcome to Background Briefing, Scott Eustace.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And Hurricane Harvey made landfall before dawn on Wednesday near the tiny town of Cameron, Louisiana, on the coast. So it sounds like New Orleans is going to dodge a bullet, but does that mean that the coast will get more and more drenching all the way from Houston to this little town of Cameron, Louisiana?
Well, yeah, I mean, it is a very active season, so we're always a bit on guard when a storm is in the Gulf of Mexico. All the way from Brownsville all the way to Mobile, Alabama, we have the nation's wetlands. We have a lot of low-lying areas, but we also have the nation's oil and gas infrastructure. So anytime you have an event like Hurricane Katrina, Riga, Gustav, Ike, Isaac, we've had many of them recently, or these giant, you know, increasingly the hurricanes seem like they have much more rainfall than they do actual hurricane surge, the big bulge of water that came into Rockport and Port Lavaca earlier in the week. Whenever we have these events, there's the potential for oily water, which is a hazard for people when they're trying to get out of flooded homes. What we have is a lack of, you know, the government's really overtaxed. They're doing a hell of a job, and often what falls through the cracks or, you know, these facilities kind of get away with dumping stuff into the environment. So we're, as an environmental organization, a network across the five Gulf states, we're coordinating with groups on the ground to make sure that these facilities are held accountable for any pollution that they let go as the floodwaters come.
And why would they do that? You've made it clear that this whole area that's been impacted by Hurricane Harvey is where all the oil and gas infrastructure, for a lot of it, for the whole United States, right? And a lot of it has to be flooded by now. Why would they dump stuff into the water?
Well, it's a part of it is just a function of the these facilities. A lot of the refineries before the hurricane made landfall were undergoing what they call shutdown processes, where you know, these refineries and such are big chemistry sets, and they just purge all of their pipes and their cat crackers before the hurricane comes. They just get rid of it all, so it doesn't come out in an uncontrolled way, or nothing explodes like during the high winds. But that means that there's just that's what they do to prepare for you know, any great surge or wind damage, rather than have it come out in an uncontrolled way. They try to minimize that by, I guess, what you call controlled releases. So some of it's just a function of having these facilities. A lot of it is a function that these facilities are all quite old. I mean, a lot of them, these plants and refineries, are more than five decades old. But we also have a lot of the waste pits for those same industries, which are exempt from a lot of hazardous materials laws. And those are problems that, you know, you'll think of the refineries, but we find that people don't think as much as some of the waste pits that are on the coast in Galveston Bay or at the aluminum plant in Point Comfort, where there was a large storm surge, or even in coastal Mississippi in Pascagoula. There's a former phosphorus waste site where the company has gone bankrupt, so no one is taking care of it. Anytime Pascagoula gets 4 inches of rain in a short period of time, that facility releases a lot of pollution into waters in Mississippi and the Gulf of Mexico. So we know from experience, you know, we live in the wetlands capital of the United States, but also like the biggest industrial corridor, that government doesn't have enough eyes on the scene during these times. So I can speak to my experience after a similar hurricane, Hurricane Isaac, which wasn't nearly as large as Harvey, but it was kind of a similar, you know, it was a Category 1 surge. It moved very slowly, and it really, a lot of the danger from the event came from the large, the inordinate amount of rain, because the hurricane didn't move very much. It didn't move very quickly. And so we had the same situation. Like in Houston, they had to release water from some of the flood retention dams. In Louisiana, they had to open a couple of the dams in Isaac. But also in Isaac, a lot of the coal terminals on the Mississippi River and oil storage facilities on the Mississippi River came off their bases and spread oil for miles, right? During Hurricane Katrina, you may have heard about the Murphy Oil Refinery, where oil storage tanks floated off their bases and just spread oil for a long way, for miles and miles around, which, you know, there were long-term problems. The soil was contaminated and people had to be relocated, but also immediately, you know, people who were either who hadn't evacuated Chalmette, or perhaps they had evacuated, but things seem a little bit calm, so they try to go back into their homes, but they find that their, you know, their neighborhood has a lot of toxic materials. I think now is the time where, you know, response is underway. To be careful of those toxic floodwaters and to make sure that everything that is being released is accounted for.
And again, I'm speaking with Scott Eustace, who's a water policy analyst and coastal wetland specialist at the Gulf Restoration Network in New Orleans. So let's specifically look into the areas affected by Hurricane Harvey around Houston and all the way into Louisiana. As you say, it's kind of like America's gas station down there in terms of all the oil industry and refineries infrastructure, and that they shut down these oil refineries before the hurricane strikes, but they purge all of the stuff that's in the pipelines, if you will, and they store it on site, and now the water has risen and flooded all these areas. So all that stuff is now flooded in and mixed in with the floodwaters, is it not?
Yeah, I think in particular, this storm was different in different places. It was large, so even down in Corpus Christi, there was significant surge of about 4 feet. In Port Lavaca, and Port Comfort, the Formosa plastics plant saw some surge, and I haven't heard any. Maybe no news is good news for Port Lavaca, but we'll be checking up on it. What we have seen in the news is a lot about Baytown, which is a small town just across from East Houston. It has a large Exxon refinery that's flooded. So a lot of the big cylindrical tanks that are on site have the potential to, the worst case is that they come off their base and release all of their contents. I think what's happened in Baytown is that the immense amount of rain has collapsed the roof of the oil tank, which just means that there's more oil being placed out into Buffalo Bayou and into Upper San Jacinto Bay and then Galveston Bay. The Buffalo Bayou is one of the main five bayous of Houston, and the eastern part of Buffalo Bayou, places like Pasadena, Manchester, Galena Park, you have low-income, mainly Latino communities just surrounded by infrastructure. So we look to groups that are on the ground concerned about these releases, like TEJAS, Texas Environmental Justice Advocacy Services, local Sierra Club, and the Bayou City Waterkeeper, to monitor oil releases into the wetlands, because we have to protect the wetlands on the Gulf Coast, because the wetlands are ultimately what protect us from hurricane surges and from these giant rains. Some people have been calling them deluges, these enormous amounts of rain, record-breaking rain. We have the hottest Gulf of Mexico water temperatures we've ever seen, so there's just more and more moisture in the air. Mm-hmm. So, the National Weather Service sometimes cannot predict when some of these rain events happen until they do happen. But the wetlands, we advocate for restoration of wetlands, whether it's inside the city of Houston with the Bayou Greenways Project, or New Orleans has something called the New Orleans Integrated Water Management Plan. Because we have to restore our wetland areas in very local places so that those will be the areas that flood rather than people's cars and homes.
Well, just in closing, though, into the future, as you get more and more these more and more powerful superstorms like Katrina and now Harvey, you've got all of this oil and gas infrastructure down there right on the coast. It's going to be impacted more, and you've got these very, very tenuous wetlands that need to be protected, and if all of the oil and waste and chemicals are all being dumped into these wetlands because of these storms, then it's obvious that these facilities, these oil and gas facilities, are in the wrong place.
Yeah, no doubt. And, you know, there were a lot of federal rules put in place during the last administration that were very good about saying, you know, perhaps you shouldn't put a vulnerable facility in what they call the 500-year floodplain. That doesn't mean the storm happens every 500 years. And really, we're seeing multiple what they call 500-year or big events happen every year in Houston and on the Gulf Coast. So that would have been a good policy. This latest administration is kind of backing away from that. Another thing is that these facilities contribute to climate change, which is heating the Gulf of Mexico. And, there were policies in place that to put a new facility, like LNG export, that's the latest craze, right? Supposedly there's going to be 60 facilities. I have my doubts that the market will bear any of that. But there are plans to put more of these dangerous facilities in areas that are becoming more and more vulnerable to climate change. But these facilities should have to account for their own contribution to that climate change, and that they should not be being placed in ports that are very vulnerable to Gulf hurricane surges and Gulf deluges, these giant rains.
Well, Scott Eustace, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much. Have a good day.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Scott Eustace, who's a water policy analyst and coastal wetland specialist at the Gulf Restoration Network in New Orleans. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back with the scientific analysis of the role of global warming in making Hurricane Harvey one of the worst unnatural disasters to hit the United States.
Don't you think it's sad what's happened to the water? Our water's going bad. Oceans, rivers, lakes, and streams have all been touched by man. Poison floating out to sea now threatens life on land.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Michael Mann, the director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State University. He's a co-founder and contributor to the award-winning science website realclimate.org. And in 2007, he shared the Nobel Peace Prize with others on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. His books include Dire Predictions, Understanding Global Warming, and his latest is The Madhouse Effect, How Climate Change Denial is Threatening Our Planet, Destroying Our Politics, and Driving Us Crazy. And he has an article at The Guardian. It's a fact. Climate change made Hurricane Harvey more deadly. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Mann.
Thanks, Ian. Always good to be with you.
Well, thank you, Michael. And it does seem that Hurricane Harvey has plenty of time to be even more deadly. That seems to be the extraordinary problem here, that it came off the Gulf, hovered over the coast, went back into the Gulf, picked up more water, and then is now back slamming Texas and Louisiana.
Yeah, well, you know, we have a new perfect storm here, don't we? This storm, just about every attribute of it has favored the storm doing maximum damage, wreaking havoc, obviously, on Houston and coastal Texas. And it's an unfortunate consequence of a whole bunch of factors that have come together.
Well, so let's talk, since there's so much science denial going on, let's talk about what's causing this extraordinary amount of moisture in the atmosphere, with the sea surface temperature rising as a result of global warming. The Clausius-Clapeyron equation, I believe, is what you call it.
Yeah.
So let's just to give us a kind of a layman's definition, if you will, or an explanation of this effect and why global warming is at play in this tragedy.
Sure, and without geeking out too much here, there is a basic relationship in atmospheric science. It actually comes from the laws of thermodynamics, and it tells us that the warmer the ocean surface, the more moisture that it can evaporate into the atmosphere, and the more moisture that there is in the atmosphere. And it's a fundamental relationship. Again, it is based on simple physics. That relationship is, in fact, exponential. So as temperatures get warmer and warmer, more and more moisture makes its way into the atmosphere and is available to a storm like this to turn into rainfall, massive amounts of rainfall. And we can estimate that for each degree Celsius of warming, there is about 7% more moisture in the atmosphere. And sea surface temperatures in the Gulf of Mexico right now are a degree and a half Celsius above their sort of mid-20th century levels. And so that means that there is about 7% more moisture in the atmosphere than there was before before global warming, before climate change, that was available to produce these flooding rains. Now, you know, Hurricane Harvey likely would have happened in the absence of climate change, but climate change has clearly exacerbated the storm. It's increased the amount of coastal flooding because more, you know, the warmer the ocean surface, the stronger the storm. That's another basic relationship that we're fairly certain about. The stronger the storm, the stronger the winds, the larger the storm surge. So we had this enhanced storm surge on top of inland flooding rains, and together that produced this disastrous tragedy that continues to unfold. Now, you allude to one other interesting characteristic of the storm, which is that it just hasn't wanted to move out of there. It has stayed pretty much locked in place, wobbling around in that area, and now wobbling back out over the ocean where there's the potential for it to re-intensify. Now, there is an active debate within the scientific community about the role that climate change might be playing in causing systems like this to become stationary. Essentially, what's happened is the jet stream has moved well up to the north, and those steering winds that would normally carry this storm along just aren't there to move it anywhere. And so it's sort of wobbling around on its own accord. There's some evidence that human-caused climate change may, in fact, be favoring precisely that sort of atmospheric configuration. But there's still, you know, some debate within the community about those specifics. And so there's certain things we know for certain. Stronger storm, bigger storm surge, warmer ocean temperatures, you know, more moisture and flooding, and let's not forget, half a foot of sea level rise over the past several decades off the coast of Texas that can be attributed to human-caused climate change. All those factors coming together to give us this disastrous impact.
And you have to add to that 15 centimeters of subsidence on the land side.
That's right,
of, because
and
of oil drilling.
From the removal of fossil fuel, in part because of oil drilling. So, absolutely.
So the land goes down, the oceans go up. That's a recipe for disaster.
Absolutely.
And again, I'm speaking with Michael Mann, the director of the Earth Systems Science Center at Penn State University. He's a co-founder and contributor to the award-winning science website realclimate.org. And in 2007, he shared the Nobel Peace Prize with others on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. His books include Dire Predictions, Understanding Global Warming, and his latest book is The Madhouse Effect, How Climate Change Denial is Threatening Our Planet, Destroying Our Politics, and Driving Us Crazy. And he has an article at The Guardian. It's a fact. Climate change made Hurricane Harvey more deadly. Now, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration apparently have released a draft of an upcoming national climate assessment, which states that there's a high confidence that these storms will increase intensity and precipitation rates, and hurricanes and typhoons in the Atlantic and the Pacific will be more intense as temperature rises further. And in the case of Harvey, apparently there's an explanation for why this hurricane managed to turn from a tropical depression to a Category 4 hurricane in little more than 2 days.
That's right.
Because it hit a patch of warm water in the Gulf of Mexico that was 4 degrees centigrade warmer than the average of any long-term data would indicate. So is that what happened here?
Yeah, so I've seen different numbers bandied around, but whether it's 4 degrees, 2 degrees, 1.5 degrees Celsius, that's a pretty large amount, and what you say is absolutely true. The warmer those ocean waters, the stronger the storm can potentially get, and the faster the intensification. When you see what we call rapid intensification, where, as you say, a storm over the course of a day and a half going from a tropical depression or tropical storm to a Cat 4 monster, and it was still intensifying when it made landfall. If it hadn't made landfall, I have little doubt that would have become a Cat 5 storm if it had more time. Now, that rapid intensification occurs when you have extremely warm ocean temperatures, as we have in the Gulf of Mexico this time of year anyways, but that's been supercharged by global warming, making them even warmer, you know, 90 degree Fahrenheit waters. And here's the thing, it isn't just at the surface. That warm water penetrates deep, and that's part of what, how climate change is impacting these storms. As the warmth from the surface penetrates down into the ocean, it's warming the entire upper ocean. Now, one of the ways that hurricanes tend to die down, one of the damping mechanisms, is that they churn up all this water and they bring cold water from beneath the surface, and that cold water is a damper on the intensification of the hurricane. But as that warmth continues to penetrate down into the ocean, we're cutting off that supply of cold water that those hurricanes used to churn up. And so we're basically taking away that damping mechanism, and that's part of what allows these systems to remain so strong for so long.
So in terms of global warming denial, it's a very bitter irony that all of the senators involved and most of the Congress people involved that represent these states in these areas impacted by Hurricane Harvey, Ted Cruz and John Cornyn, the Texas Republican senators, Greg Abbott, the governor, Dan Patrick, the lieutenant governor, former right-wing talk show host, they're all global warming deniers.
That's right.
As are the two senators from Louisiana and most of the Congress people, except the one congressperson from Baton Rouge, apparently is not a global warming denier. And they're trying to get something like $50 billion to restore the wetlands as a barrier against these hurricanes because of, one, the subsidence from oil drilling, and two, just rampant development, which is very much the case in and around Houston. So it's a bit extraordinary, isn't it, to see these senators wanting money for the damage done by these superstorms, but not wanting to talk about what causes them.
Yeah, and what makes them worse, exactly. In the case of Governor Abbott, you're right. On the campaign trail, he was quoted in, the San Antonio paper, just sort of parroting a laundry list of standard climate change denial talking points while he was on the campaign trail. So he's a climate change denier. And more than that, he was one of the politicians who was trying to sue the EPA to prevent them from enforcing the Clean Power Plan, which is a plan to help us transition away from our reliance on fossil fuels, which is hurting us, damaging the planet through climate change, to renewable energy. And he tried to sue the government to prevent them from doing that. So there are so many levels of irony here and culpability when it comes to politicians in states like Texas that are on the front lines of the impacts of climate change and who have done so many things to basically impair the ability of their own citizens to deal with storms like this and the impact that climate change is having on them.
Well, this whole administration, though, is led by a climate change denier, President Trump. And just 2 weeks ago, he rescinded an executive order of Barack Obama's to improve infrastructure, particularly in Louisiana and in Texas on the Gulf there, to mandate more stringent building codes for bridges and buildings, et cetera, that they could withstand these kind of superstorms. And again, it's breathtaking what's going on.
Yeah, these regulations are there for a reason, to protect people. And you have Trump and congressional Republicans who are now trying to ram through an agenda of basically getting rid of all of these regulations that are there to protect us and our environment.
Well, the worst part of it is, though, it goes beyond denial and into very deep cynicism when you look at the deal that, for example, the Secretary of State Tillerson, formerly of Exxon, made with Putin, which they still want to do, which is to get the last hurrah of big oil, where they'll try and get the Arctic oil out and the Siberian oil out, which is entirely dependent upon the effects of global warming, because it's only because of the melting ice caps, is is this feasible? So so you take advantage of global warming, and then you extract more oil and gas, which then contributes further to global warming, and you prolong our dependence on fossil fuels while obstructing and preventing the critical move to renewables.
No, that's right. And you add on, you know, on top of that, the fact that ExxonMobil was engaged in a campaign to bury their own internal research that goes back to the 1970s, their own scientists, and we've seen the internal documents now. Their own scientists warned that the impacts of our continued extraction and burning of fossil fuels could be, and I use I quote directly, the Exxon scientists, could be catastrophic in terms of its impact on our climate. And now, of course, we are reaping what we had sown. And decades of inaction and decades of ExxonMobil and other fossil fuel interests trying to bury that science and in fact attacking other independent science demonstrating the reality and threat of climate change, that, you know, we are now experiencing the severe effects of decades, a decades-long campaign of denial and delay, and we're all paying for it now. And this latest storm is just one example.
So I read a quote from a Republican, and it might have been a scientist or a senator, I'm not sure, but somebody that was one of those few Republicans who accept the science of global warming, and he was referring to Trump rescinding Obama's executive order on infrastructure improvement in order to combat these superstorms in the future. And his critique was, well, I think it's misplaced because, frankly, Trump is just manically determined to undo everything and anything that Obama did. But assuming that that wasn't the motive here, his argument was, well, because the executive order mentioned global warming, it's just a red rag to a bull. So is there any point to that kind of argument? In other words, a lot of apologists for this ridiculous, unnecessary argument about whether global warming is not real and this delaying tactic that it provides the polluters with, that if Al Gore, for example, wasn't the first person to champion the issue, then we'd be better off. Do you buy that theory?
No, not entirely. There's a grain of truth to that theory, as far as I'm concerned, which is that Al Gore was a partisan political figure, and so when he became sort of the figurehead of the climate movement, as it were, that provided a means for those who had been looking to divide the public on this issue, fossil fuel interests who had been spending tens of millions of dollars in an ongoing disinformation campaign to confuse the public and policymakers about the reality and threat of climate change. That goes back to the early 1990s. And so what they realized was that when sort of in the 2000s, when Al Gore really became the true figurehead of the climate movement, with the Inconvenient Truth back in 2006, that provided them a wedge. That provided the cynics, the critics, a way of dividing the public by saying, oh, look, see, it's all about politics because the figurehead of this movement is Al Gore and he's a Democrat. This is really about partisan politics. And by the way, if you want to be a good, self-respecting Republican, you have to be on board as a good member of the tribe. You have to commit to our principle of climate change denialism. So these cynical fossil fuel interests and those doing their bidding were able to use this to sort of organize the rank and file into this rabble that we now have of climate change deniers who parrot these talking points and who have helped, they are the foot soldiers in this war on science and specifically the war on the science of climate change and on the reality of climate change.
Well, the main megaphone that they've had, as far as I can tell, has been Fox News.
Right.
And Rupert Murdoch, I have no idea why he does what he does But his son James apparently is not as crazy and not a global warming denier as apparently is Trump's daughter Ivanka, and she apparently brought Al Gore in to meet during the transition in Trump Tower, along with Leo DiCaprio, who's an activist trying to draw attention to the planet in peril as a result of climate change.
Yeah.
In all cases, it appears to be futile. So do you see any chance of a generational shift here in terms of these old bilious billionaires are suddenly sort of eased out because of and a new generation comes in who would be more aware of the fact that their children, their grandchildren are going to inherit a very compromised planet?
Yeah, perhaps. Let's hope so. Thus far, unfortunately, what we've seen is that, you know, the Jared Kushners and Ivanka Trumps and Trump meeting with Leo DiCaprio and Al Gore seems to have all been for show. This is a way of Trump and the cronies whose agenda he's basically representing. It's a way of them saying, oh, look, you know, we've talked to climate champions, as well as, you know, fossil fuel folks. We're listening to all sides. It's a way of them, in essence, legitimizing an agenda that from the very start, I'm convinced, was going to be all about doubling down on fossil fuels and discrediting concern over climate change. And to be able to trot out, you know, some climate champions, to be able to say, look, we've met with Al Gore and Leonardo DiCaprio, was a way for them to, you know, it was a public relations coup for them, as far as I'm concerned. And look, climate change denial is as climate change denial does. Look at what, you know, agenda they've pursued. And, you know, with Murdoch, one of the things that's little appreciated is the fact that the News Corp, the corporation that Murdoch is chair of, that owns Fox News, the Wall Street Journal, and many other media outlets around the world, the second largest shareholder of News Corp stock is the Saudi royal family. So there has always been a vested interest with News Corp in undermining public understanding of climate change and engaging in efforts to boost the sale of fossil fuels and the use of fossil fuels. I have heard similar things to what you describe when it comes to James Murdoch. And, you know, we can hold out some hope that maybe that generational passing of the baton will mean a different outlook by News Corp, by Fox News, and the Wall Street Journal editorial pages, who are two of the largest promoters of climate change denialism. But I'll be honest, I'm not holding my breath on that.
Well, Michael Mann, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian. Always a pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Michael Mann, who's the director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State University. He's a co-founder and contributor to the award-winning science website realclimate.org. And in 2007, he shared the Nobel Peace Prize with others on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. His books include Dire Predictions, Understanding Global Warming. His latest book is The Madhouse Effect, How Climate Change Denial is Threatening Our Planet, Destroying Our Politics, and Driving Us Crazy. And he has an article at The Guardian. It's a fact. Climate change made Hurricane Harvey more deadly. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into Trump's presentation today in Missouri of his tax overhaul plan that was light on details but heavy on promises.
There's been a crash on the levee and mama, you've been refused. Well, it's king for king and it's queen for queen. This is gonna be the meanest flood that anybody's ever seen. Oh, mama, you're gonna miss your best friend now. You're gonna have to find yourself.
Outside the passion millions, put them into power. Expect a little more back for their taxes. Like school books, beds in hospitals, and peace in our bloody time. All they get is old men grinding axes.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Harry Stein, who is the Director of Fiscal Policy at the Center for American Progress, where he focuses on the tax and spending choices within the federal budget. He has written extensively about appropriations, tax expenditures, and the budget outlook, and previously worked as a legislative assistant to Senator Herb Cole. Welcome to Background Briefing, Harry Stein.
Thank you. It's good to be on.
Well, thank you, Harry. And today, President Trump went to Missouri. He obviously wants to unseat Senator Claire McCaskill, declaring war on her. But he took the occasion to announce his new tax overhaul. But there are very, very few specifics beyond the fact that he offered up a 15% corporate tax rate, which is the current rate, is 35%. That's about the only specifics that so far I can find. And yet he said it's time to give the American workers a pay raise that they have been looking for many, many years. So how does a 20% reduction in corporate tax rate give the American worker a pay raise?
It doesn't. And I think that the rhetoric that they're using is indicative of how unpopular they recognize that this message is. It's policy of cutting corporate taxes and not at all what people that voted for President Trump were looking for when he talked about, you know, the forgotten man and woman. Corporate taxes aren't, you know, cutting corporate taxes helps corporate CEOs and helps people that own corporations. It doesn't help workers. And, you know, keep in mind, the statutory corporate tax rate is 35%. Everyone that talks about corporate tax cuts loves to cite that, but that's not the rate the corporations actually pay because of all the loopholes and deductions that a real tax reform should be closing. Corporations really pay a rate closer to 23%. And so when you're talking about such a huge cut in the rate and not talking about that in the context of saying, here's how we're going to go after all these loopholes and ways that corporations aren't paying their fair share, they're actually going to be paying a lot less than 15%. It's going to be a huge corporate tax cut that just helps those at the top, and workers are going to be left behind. But, you know, I think what you're hearing is, you know, populist rhetoric because they recognize that corporate tax cuts are not what people are looking for. But the rhetoric does not match the reality here.
But don't a lot of the big corporations, including some that are not considered to be evil, to use the Google term, like Apple, don't they park an enormous amount of their profits offshore and don't pay taxes?
Right. And, you know, so this, the way that they are able to shift profits offshore, and oftentimes those are profits that really are earned in the U.S., and then they use accounting gimmicks to put them on paper, put them in tax havens. That's one of the biggest ways the corporations aren't paying their fair share of taxes and one of the loopholes that should be closed in the context of tax reform. Now, what Trump has talked about in the past, again, as you said, the speech was quite light on details, was what they call a territorial tax system. And what that means, it's kind of a complicated, nice-sounding word, but what it means is that companies would pay zero profits, zero taxes in the United States on their foreign profits. They'd pay U.S. taxes on their U.S. profits, but they would no longer pay any U.S. taxes on their foreign profits. So if anything, that just encourages companies to offshore jobs even more, and it does nothing to close the loopholes that let companies stash money offshore for tax purposes. One thing to stress here, though, when we talk about the money that's stashed offshore for tax purposes, it's not as if this money is like under a mattress in the Cayman Islands just doing nothing. In fact, oftentimes the money is actually held in U.S. bank accounts or buying U.S. stocks. It is invested oftentimes in the U.S. economy. They can't do share buybacks. They can't do dividends to their shareholders. And they can't invest in their own U.S. operations. But oftentimes the money is in the U.S. So I think we exaggerate. You know, there's this, I think, image in people's heads of this tidal wave of money that could come from offshore back to the U.S. and you know, be this huge boon for investment. And that's not really the case. There's money that's stashed offshore for tax purposes, and we ought to be collecting taxes on it, but it's not as if there's some huge pent-up investment boom that would happen, you know, in that event.
Well, of course, I recall that Donald Trump said that American workers are paid too much, and he certainly dropped that line in the campaign where he was successful in winning over a lot of blue-collar, white, working-class Democrats who would normally have voted Democrat, at least have in the past. So what is the magic here? How does this guy get away with being able to stiff the American worker, make these phony promises, give tax cuts to American corporations. Not that this is a done deal, but he already has made it clear that he would like to reduce the 39.6% tax rate for the highest earners in this country down to between 20 and 25%. So it's pretty clear what his intentions are, which is to take care of himself, his family, and his wealthy friends. So what is, how does he get away with this? How does he still have 35% of the public thinking he's draining the swamp?
Well, it is amazing that he still gets away with it. And, 35%, that approval rating has come down, so he's getting away with it less and less. But I think, during the campaign, when people heard Donald Trump, I think a lot of them thought they were hearing a different kind of Republican, that they thought they were hearing someone who was actually finally going to look out for them and not just, like the Ryan budget, cut taxes at the top, give wealthy people and corporations a break, and take that out of Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. Remember, Trump said he wasn't going to cut Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. He's broken those promises in his budget and in his push to repeal the Affordable Care Act. But I think people thought that they were hearing a different kind of Republican. And what we're seeing more and more is that when it comes to tax, budget, economic policy, this is the same old trickle-down economics. They've got Stephen Miller apparently writing this speech. He's one of the leading, white nationalists in the administration, an acolyte of Steve Bannon. I think that they're putting a coat of paint on this that's kind of wrapping it up in this Trump populist sheen, but it's the same old trickle-down economics, and I do think that people are starting to see through that more and more. But during the campaign, I think people, unfortunately thought they were hearing something different when they weren't.
But isn't Trump likely to blow all of this up in the sense that you've got all this relief money that's pending for the Hurricane Harvey relief in Texas and also, I guess, in Louisiana to a lesser extent. And even though Senator Ted Cruz, of course, and Cornyn were both voted against relief for Sandy in New Jersey and New York and Connecticut, they nevertheless want it for Texas. But let's assume that that's a priority. Trump's already threatened to shut the government down to get his money for the border wall. Whether or not he'd go so far as to default on the debt ceiling, which would be a catastrophe for the American economy and for the U.S. dollar, that's still hovering out there. So what's your sense of the real priorities here? Because my understanding is that what Trump's all about is, since he doesn't have a clue about what he's doing, he's completely out of his depth. And the reason he panders to this shrinking 35%, whatever it is, the white nationalist sort of hardline core that he keeps throwing a bone to, pardoning Arpaio, you name it, it's one stunt after another. That seems to be his real focus. And he's promised this ridiculous wall. And I don't see him getting out from under that promise, because it sort of doesn't it blow the whole pretense about who he is and what he promised in the campaign? If he can't deliver on that, then isn't what good is he to these to the people who believe that he's draining the swamp?
Well, and he really hasn't delivered on. I mean, he's done these, as you say, really damaging stunts, pardoning Arpaio, and not just stunts, I should say. I mean, I think, he hasn't come any closer to building the wall, but there's been, really, awful stories about immigration, detentions and roundups and mass deportations that they have started to do. That's been, really devastating for families and communities. I mean, there's a lot of bad things happening, but no major legislative accomplishments to hang his hat on. I get worried where this goes, as you say, with the need to raise the debt ceiling, and Trump has tried to threaten to shut down the government if we don't get, if he doesn't get his wall built, which he, by the way, admitted in a call to the leader of Mexico wasn't even really that important. It was just a political ploy. But I think that, on so many of these things, Trump has made these absurd statements and also less absurd statements. We were talking about earlier during the campaign, where he sounded you know, like he wasn't like all those other Republicans, and he talked about helping workers and families. But his administration, that's not the administration that they are. That's not the policy agenda that they've either even tried to carry out or been successful in carrying out. And, you know, so we've got a lot of things that have to happen just to keep the lights on with regard to keeping the government open, not defaulting on the national debt, responding to this awful natural disaster in Houston and doing that in a competent and timely fashion.
By the way, let me just correct you there. It's not entirely a natural disaster. It's a little unnatural because there's a huge component of global warming, which we discussed early in the program with an expert on meteorology and weather, Michael Mann. So it's pretty clear that it's not a natural disaster. It's a natural disaster helped by man-made climate change, which, by the way, all of those senators that represent both Louisiana and Texas deny is a problem.
That's absolutely right. And, you know, there's actually this relates to what we're talking about now with cutting taxes for corporations and the wealthy. You know, Trump's budget attacked programs, like zeroed out programs that were about monitoring and understanding and responding to climate change because they want to pretend it doesn't exist. He even cut FEMA programs for disaster assistance and flood mapping. I mean, that was the agenda in the budget. And the reason that his budget was making those cuts was to make room for huge tax cuts for the wealthy and corporations. I mean, it's all kind of a piece. The way that those kinds of tax cuts are going to hollow out the government services that we all need, and one of the reasons that we need them is to prepare for and respond to disasters, natural and man-made alike. And you're absolutely right that climate change seems to be playing a role here.
But I don't see how Trump can get out from under the fact that he really hammered this theme, and he's been hammering it forever about the wall and Mexico's going to pay for it. But he just reinforced it just recently in Arizona and has said that he will shut down the government unless he gets money for his wall. And nobody wants to give him money for his wall. And there's going to be the competing needs for hurricane relief money. So to me, that's the next train wreck, isn't it? Irrespective of whether how long are they going to be talking about this budget? Surely, the shutdown is we're talking about the end of September, aren't we? So it's looming quicker than the budget negotiations. They could go on for months.
That's absolutely right. And you know, this is it's incredibly bizarre to be worried about a government shutdown. Certainly, to be worried about defaulting on the national debt at a time when the same political party controls the White House, the House, and the Senate. I mean, the fact that they can't get their act together to just do the basics. I mean, it's one thing when there's divided government and you have these kinds of standoffs over things like over government funding bills and there's the potential for a shutdown. It shouldn't happen, but you understand it in times of divided government. This is just one party not being able to get its act together. And, you know, hopefully we can get through September and keep the government open and avoid a default on the national debt, respond to Harvey. But even if they can, what's expected is that they'll keep the government open just for a couple of months. And so all of these same fights over, you know, funding this wall that Trump has admitted privately isn't really that important. And you know, all of all of that agenda and all that brinksmanship and the inability of the same party that's running things in the White House and Congress to get its act together, even if we get through that in September, we're probably just going to be back here in a couple of months fighting the same fights.
Well, I'm wondering, though, whether the fissures within the Republican Party are going to be more pronounced in terms of those that are sticking by Trump as he becomes more and more indefensible and his wall becomes more and more absurd. And his threats to shut down the government become more and more extreme. Already, I noticed that the former Republican Senator John Danforth wrote a piece in the Washington Post last Friday where he called upon his Republican colleagues, particularly in the Senate, to stand up, and I quote, to stand up and save the party, the GOP, from this hateful man. That's a pretty strong statement coming from a very highly respected Republican, former Republican senator.
Wow. No, that is a great statement, and I wish that there were more currently serving Republican elected officials who were willing to say that. You know, it's been really disappointing how few have been. I mean, there's certainly been some that have been willing to say, you know, kind of shake their head and say, well, I'm very concerned, but you know, that's fine for you and me to say, but if you're actually an elected official and actually in a position to do something about it, then do something about it. And, you know, I don't know at what point Republicans in Congress finally say enough is enough, what it would take for Paul Ryan to say enough is enough. My concern is that, I mean, I hope I'm wrong, but it seems like the thing that's holding all of them together and is that they really do want to cut taxes for the wealthy and corporations. I mean, that is the Ryan budget. They want these tax cuts very, very badly.
Well, I'd call it the Koch brothers. Isn't it the Koch brothers budget?
Right. Yeah, that's absolutely right. Yeah. And this is a budget there was actually an amazing quote in the Wall Street Journal from the president of Club for Growth, which is an interest group that supports tax cuts for the wealthy, that said, you know, the GOP donor class supports this agenda, and so it's going to be easier to get the votes. I mean, that's kind of a remarkable thing to say out loud.
Right.
But I think, you know, as long as they think there's a chance to get these tax cuts, unfortunately, Republicans in Congress are going to be loath to break with President Trump, even on the most egregious things that he does. And I hope I'm wrong about that, but so far that's been the case.
Well, Americans for Progress, which is a Koch brothers front, are already talking about a huge ad campaign that they're going to finance to sell this plan if it ever emerges. So, you know, the Koch brothers are going to be out there selling it, this huge tax cut for billionaires. And I guess Chuck Schumer, on the other hand, is talking about getting together a campaign, a counter campaign on TV to let the American people know that working Americans and middle class Americans are going to get hosed. So it'll be the battle of the TV ads, right? And as we go into the next few months,
absolutely. You know, I mean, I think that the taxes are going to be moving to center stage. You know, certainly the bulk of the money is on the side of the moneyed interest and people like the Koch brothers and Americans for Prosperity, and you know, there'll be a lot of advertisements like that. On the other side, there is a campaign that progressives have launched. It's called Not One Penny, as in not one penny of tax cuts for the wealthy and corporations. That should be a line that we could all agree on. You know, there's real tax reform that you can do that's not just about cutting taxes for rich people. And, you know, the Not One Penny campaign has raised money to launch ads. So there is counter programming where there are messages that people will see why we shouldn't cut taxes for the wealthy and corporations. But more importantly, that's going to be I think, like we saw with healthcare, you're starting to see this widespread mobilization of people saying, hold on, why is this the agenda? You know, if you remember, we had the tax march a few months ago on tax day on April 15th, where people came out in cities across the country and said, hey, release your tax returns. And certainly, given how much Donald Trump potentially stands to benefit from huge tax cuts, the American people have, you know, we shouldn't have any kind of tax bill without knowing how that's going to benefit the president who's going around the country campaigning for it and signing it into law potentially. So I think that you know, certainly the money will be on the side of cutting taxes for the wealthy, but there will, but I think that the energy and the voters will be on the other side. And, you know, ultimately we'll see whose side Congress is on.
Well, Harry Stein, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Well, thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Harry Stein, who's the Director of Fiscal Policy at the Center for American Progress, where he focuses on the tax and spending choices within the federal budget. He has written extensively about appropriations, tax expenditures, and the budget outlook, and previously worked as a legislative assistant to Senator Herb Cole. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.